Well, good morning. My name's Brendan. I'm one of the ministers here. Can I extend you a very warm welcome? Now, I know what you're thinking. First, you're thinking, poor Kathy, how did she draw the short straw in having to read that? Well, she swapped with her daughter. That's why. And second, could you choose a more boring passage for Christmas, Brendan? Abraham, the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah. I mean, your Christmas flyer said, come and find rest in the Christmas rush. I didn't think that meant boring me to death, Brendan. What about the baby in the manger? What about the three wise men and the gold and frankincense and myrrh? Or as one child put it, Frankenstein and myrrh. Just tell me about those wonderful things. I mean, have a look at the very next verse in the passage. It says, this is how the birth of Jesus, the Messiah, came about. That's the kind of passage we should be looking at Christmas time, Brendan, surely. Well, strangely enough, Matthew doesn't begin his gospel with the story of Jesus' birth. He begins with a genealogy or a family tree of Jesus. And he does this for a very good reason. The reason being that in traditional cultures, your family tree is your resume. Now, what's a resume? A resume is sort of like a one or two page document that you send in to a prospective employer if you want to introduce yourself and let them get to know you. Okay? Now, in the West, our resume is all about our education and our work career, isn't it? And they're the things that we honor. We honor a good education and a respectable career. But in more traditional cultures, what they cared about was having a respectable family tree. And so before Matthew tells us about Jesus' birth, he wants to introduce us to this Jesus by giving us his resume. But here's the thing. This resume in front of us is the exact opposite of what we would expect. You see, what we would expect would be a glowing summary of Jesus' family credentials. I mean, that's what people do today, isn't it? They send in a resume and we like to tweak our resume a bit, make us look a bit better than perhaps is actually the case. I heard of one young job applicant that put on her resume, proficient in multiple software platforms, And she got into the interview, and the interviewer said, so does that include things like Windows and Office and web design? And the young girl says, oh, no, I'm talking about things like Snapchat and Instagram and Pinterest and Twitter. So she's like tweaking her resume. We try to do that, don't we? Just make ourselves sound a bit more impressive. But Jesus, he does the exact opposite of this. As we're going to see, this resume is warts and all. It's warts and all. But what we're going to see is that it is the warts of Jesus' resume that brings enormous comfort and enormous rest to God's people. And there are our first two points for this morning. I'm sorry we couldn't get the screen up behind us, but I've got three points this morning. The first is Jesus brings us comfort. The second is Jesus brings us rest. But the third thing that this genealogy tells us is that Jesus also requires a response. And without a proper response to Jesus, we can't actually get the first two points. We can't actually get the comfort and the rest. But what we want to do is we want to find rest in the Christmas rush. So let's look at how Jesus brings comfort, how Jesus brings rest, and then thirdly, how Jesus requires a response. Now, like I said, this resume is the exact opposite of what we would expect. And the reason it's the opposite is because Matthew includes in this genealogy some very shocking things. Now, they're not necessarily shocking to Western ears, but in Jesus' day, they were shocking. And the first thing that he shocks us with, and he's trying to grab our attention, right? But the first thing he shocks us with is that Matthew includes women in this family tree. Now, to modern ears, that's normal. I mean, come on, Brendan, it's 2019. We expect gender inclusivity. But all the way back then, you didn't include women in your family tree. The reason being that, sadly, back then, women didn't count. All right, none of the genealogies in the Old Testament have women in them because women did not bring honor to your name. But something changed with the coming of Jesus. And the thing that changed is that Jesus wants women in his resume. Why? Because he's proud of the women in his family. And so Jesus goes completely against his culture to include women because Jesus is proud of the women in his family tree. However, it gets even more shocking than mentioning women, which is the first time that that happened in the Bible. These were no ordinary women. Several of them were actually Gentiles. Now, what I mean by Gentile? A Gentile is anyone who's not a Jew. So basically, these women are foreigners. So if you see in verse 5, if you've got it there, it says, Salmon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Now, Rahab was a Canaanite. And for those who are familiar with the Old Testament stories, the Canaanites were the people that God kicked out of the promised land because they were so evil. And then still in verse 5, Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Ruth was a Moabite, another foreigner. And Moabites were actually not allowed in the temple. God forbade them from going in the temple. And then in verse 6, David, the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife, and Uriah was a Hittite, another Gentile. Now, why would Matthew go to all the trouble of mentioning these Gentiles? Well, it's because not only is Jesus proud to have women in his family tree, he is also proud to have foreigners in his family tree too. You see, to ancient Jews, having a Gentile in your family tree meant you were not of pure blood. But something happened with the coming of Jesus. Jesus wants people from the wrong pedigree in his resume. Why? Because Jesus loves having people of the wrong race or the wrong class or the wrong family upbringing. He loves having people like that in his family tree. He is proud to have people like that in his family tree. But it gets even more shocking than this. Not only is he proud to have women in this genealogy, not only is he proud to have Gentiles in this genealogy, but he also has sinners in this genealogy too. So Rahab was a prostitute. Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, was an adulterer. And David actually had Uriah assassinated so he could steal his wife. Now, why would Matthew include some of the worst sinners in the Bible in Jesus' resume? Because not only is he proud to have women, not only is he proud to have foreigners, but Jesus is even proud to have the worst of sinners in his resume. Now, this is not a pride like that, like Aussies have a pride of, you know, when we have a convict in our background. It's like, yeah, I've got convict blood in me. It was shameful back then to have like a prostitute or an adulterer or a murderer in your genealogy. But something changed with the coming of Jesus. Jesus wants sinners on his resume. Why? Because he is proud to have all manner of people, no matter who you are or what you've done. Jesus is proud to have you in his family. Now, friends, you may have come here this morning thinking, Jesus could never want me. I'm a poor immigrant. I'm a high school dropout. I'm a divorcee. I'm from the wrong side of the tracks. Or perhaps you're thinking, look, I ignore Jesus every other day of the year. I ridicule him and mock his followers. Or perhaps you're sitting there thinking, Brendan, you have no idea what I've done in my life. Jesus would never want a sinner like me. If that sounds like you, then please know that Jesus is calling you to be a part of his family this Christmas. If only you would respond to that call. Right? Jesus is saying, come to me this Christmas, no matter who you are, no matter what you've done, and I will be proud of you. So, that's the first thing Jesus brings, comfort in knowing that no matter who we are, no matter what our background, no matter what we've done, Jesus is proud of us. But how can this be? All right, that's the big question that this throws into my mind. How can Jesus be proud of someone who is as worthless and as sinful as me? Well, we actually get the answer in a second shocking thing that Matthew includes in his genealogy. So the first shocking thing is these women of mixed background. The second shocking thing comes in verse 17. Now, you may have sort of brushed over it very quickly, but let me read verse 17 for you. The genealogy finishes like this. Thus, there were 14 generations in all from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile in Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah. Now, the thing that is shocking about this is that there isn't 14 generations from Abraham to David, or from David to the exile, or from the exile to Jesus. And Matthew's original readers would have known this, because they were Jewish, and because they were Jewish, they had access to the Old Testament genealogies, and they could have cross-checked the references, and when they did that, they would have found that Matthew has skipped over a whole bunch of generations. Now, why would Matthew do this? Why would he purposefully skip generations, knowing that people would know that? Well, it's because his agenda here is not to write a history book, it is to introduce Jesus, okay? And so Matthew skips certain generations to create a nice, neat little structure of three groups of 14 names. Now, why does he want to create three groups of 14 names? Because three groups of 14 would have set alarm bells off for his original readers. And the reason it would have set alarm bells off for his original readers is because three groups of 14 is also six groups of seven. And six groups of seven sets off enormous alarm bells for the Jews. Let me explain why, all right? So firstly, the number seven is a very important number in the Old Testament. Those who heard this last night, don't call out. But do you know why number seven is so important? How many days did it take God to create the world? Did someone say six? Good. I was trying to trick you, but you're too smart this morning. Too smart. He created the world in 6 days, but on the seventh day, God rested. And the reason he set aside the seventh day as a day of rest, and the reason he set aside the seventh day as a day of rest for all eternity was to point forward to the Sabbath rest that is to come in heaven. But it gets even better than that, because not only was there a Sabbath day each week, there was actually a Sabbath year in the Old Testament. We learn about this in Deuteronomy 15. Every 7 years, the Israelites were supposed to cancel all debts and set all slaves free. Why? Because the Sabbath year pointed to the Sabbath rest that was still to come in heaven. All right. So the Sabbath year set off alarm bells for the Jews. But then in Leviticus 25, we're told about a year of Jubilee. Now, what's a year of Jubilee? That is seven groups of seven Sabbath years. So every 49 years, not only were all debts cancelled, not only were all slaves set free, but all land was returned to its original owners. So if in some time during the last 49 years you had fallen on hard times and you'd had to sell your land, that land was returned to you free of charge. It's one of the ways you could look after the poor. And so when the Jews read that Jesus is the seventh out of six groups of seven, massive alarm bells go off, because that means that Jesus is the Jubilee. And the point of the Jubilee is to point to the Sabbath rest that is to come. And so if Jesus is the seventh seven, then that means Jesus brings rest. But what is this rest, I hear you ask? I mean, that's what we're here to hear about today. What is this rest? Well, the rest Jesus brings actually comes at Easter. Now, I know we're here to celebrate Christmas today, but as our regulars know, you cannot have Christmas without Easter, just like you cannot have Easter without Christmas, okay? And so what happened at Easter was two things. And we need to understand these two things to understand our rest. So the first thing that happened is that Jesus, at the cross, exposed all our faults, all our weaknesses, and all our sins. He actually laid us bare. Because at the cross is where Jesus is giving us that look of disappointment. And he's waving his finger at us, saying, "You deserve God's condemnation for your sin. In fact, you are so sinful that the only thing that will save you from being condemned by God is the death of an immortal being." Now, it's hard enough putting a price on a human life, isn't it? Imagine trying to value an immortal life. How much would that cost? But that's what Jesus is saying. That's what I've come to do. I've come to give up an immortal life to atone for your sin. Right, so that's the first thing that's happening at the cross. The second thing that's happening at the cross is that Jesus is saying, but I am willing to do that for you. I am willing to lay down my life for you. Why? Because I love you in spite of all that sin. See, the Christian message is very simple. It has 2 points. Point number one, you are way more sinful than you ever dare admit. But point number two, you are way more loved than you ever dreamed possible. And if we can hold those two things together, that brings true rest. Let me explain what I mean. See, true rest means not having to work to make everyone think I'm okay anymore. Not having to work to make God think I'm okay. Not having to work to make me think I'm okay. It means not having to show people how awesome a person I am all the time. It means not having to keep that facade up. That I've actually got my life together. Right? Doing that is tiring. There's a movie, I don't know if you've seen it, it's called Flight. It's got Denzel in it. He's this airline pilot, and he takes off with a full load of passengers, and something catastrophic goes wrong in the airplane, and it takes this massive nosedive, and he realizes this is the only way to save the plane is to turn a Boeing 747 upside down. And then he flips it back over just in enough time to land. And he does it, and only one person dies. It is an amazing feat. But he was blind drunk at the time. And the whole movie is about him trying to hide the fact that he was drunk from all the investigators. And it's tiring. And you see it wear him out. And it's not until the very end that he actually just comes clean and admits, yep, I was drunk that day. And you see him at the end at rest, at peace. Friends, that's true rest. The Bible says until we admit that we deserve God's condemnation for our sin, then we have to keep running. We have to keep working. We have to keep up the facade of being a good person. Right, let me ask you, are you sitting here this morning feeling like a failure? Perhaps you're racked with guilt or insecurity, inferiority. Maybe you're anxious that people are going to find out what you're really like. Maybe you're angry at that person who pointed out one of your faults all those years ago. Now, friends, if that's you, then you're still running. You're still working. Jesus offers you true rest this Christmas. True rest comes from doing what Denzel did in that movie. He just admitted, I deserve God's condemnation for my sin. But at the same time, it is knowing that the God of the universe has taken that condemnation for us in the cross. So, the only question left is, how do we get this comfort and this rest? We've seen how Jesus brings comfort, okay? And how Jesus brings rest. How do we get these great things? Well, it is by responding to the person of Jesus. You see, the reason Matthew starts his gospel with the genealogy is to show that this isn't a fairy tale. You notice, we read the opening verse, it doesn't start with once upon a time. It doesn't start with a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Right, Matthew starts his gospel by putting Jesus into history. And Jesus, if he is a historical figure like the Bible is claiming, then things get a little irritating for us. Let me explain what I mean. You see, if the story of Jesus were just some fairy tale, then we can learn from it, but we don't have to do anything about it. Well, it's like any fairy tale. Picture Peter Pan. Peter Pan tells us, imagine if we were never going to grow old and never die. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Beauty and the Beast has a great story. It says, no matter how ugly or beastly we've made ourselves, wouldn't it be great if there was a love out there that could break through our ugliness and transform us back to our original selves, our true selves. Or Sleeping Beauty says perhaps we're not supposed to sleep in death. Wouldn't it be great if there were a prince out there who could come and awake us from the sleep of death? Now, they're lovely stories, all right? But because they're fairy tales, we can either take them or leave them. We can meditate on those wonderful messages, or we can just close the book on them and get on with life. The thing that's irritating about the Bible is that it says that Jesus was a real person. And if Jesus is a real person, then that means God has broken into history. And that means every single human is going to be judged according to how we respond to the person of Jesus. Right? If the death and resurrection of Jesus is real, then the Christmas message is not some fairy tale. It is an objective reality that we must respond to. Now, that's quite irritating, isn't it? Until we realize how rewarding and how simple it is to actually respond to Jesus. Now, we've seen how rewarding it is, okay? We've seen the rest that he brings from trying to prove ourselves over and over again. We can just let that all go. And we've seen the comfort that comes from knowing that Jesus, if we put our faith in him, he's proud to have us, all right? But it's also really simple to respond to Jesus. So I want to close just by showing the two very simple steps that we need to respond to Jesus. Step one in responding to Jesus is we need to admit we're sinful. We need to admit that we need God's forgiveness. Right? Only those who actually admit their sin, like Denzel in the movie Flight, can actually rest from trying to prove themselves over and over every single day. So step one is we need to admit we're sinful. Step two is we need to place our trust in Jesus. Now, what does that mean? Well, in a nutshell, it means calling upon God to help us follow what he tells us in his word and apologize when we mess up. It's that simple. And what the Bible shows is if we're doing that, then God is proud to have us as part of his family. So, friends, this Christmas, even though today some of us may be working and cooking a Christmas meal, but many of us have finished our work for the year. The problem is many of us will still be working to try and prove ourselves, perhaps to our family, to ourselves, or to God. And friends, that's tiring. It's tiring keeping up that facade. See, what Jesus wants this Christmas is for you to rest. And that means to rest in the knowledge that though we're sinful, Jesus has taken that sin away so he can now look upon us with pride. Friends, I pray that you find true rest this Christmas.